In today's series, we have Femi Odugbemi, the founder of Zuri 24 Media. Femi is a Nigerian documentary filmmaker, screenwriter, cinematographer, director, producer, and photographer. Interviewing Femi on the series today is Umi Yakubu. Umi is a producer, writer, editor, game designer, and developer. Join us as we listen to their journey in entrepreneurship within the Nigerian entertainment industry.
So tell me a bit about what you do.
Well, I'm a content entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I make content on television, I make films, I make TV programming.
Right.
But I also, I run an entertainment and content production company called Zuri 24 Media. I also am into training and mentorship. So I'm also academy director for the Multi-Choice Talent Factory. But my activities is basically in the entertainment and content arena.
Okay. So can you talk me a bit through to how you got into the space? Like say post tertiary institution, how did you get into that space? I know you started working with NTA initially. So from then on, how did...
Well, I'd always wanted to be a storyteller, a filmmaker of some kind. I mean, I grew up in Lagos where we only played football or went to cinemas. And we watched a lot of Indian films, I promise you. So it was very easy for a lot of us to want to be in the business of film or the business of storytelling. So yeah, I did go to film school. And when I came back to Nigeria, I started initially at NTA. But that didn't take very long because it was very easy to reconsider working in the civil service when you think of, you know, how much work you have to do and how little pay can come back from that. So I went into advertising first because I could write stories. I went into advertising. I worked at Lintas Advertising, which at that time was one of the bigger companies. And from Lintas, I was part of a team that formed STB McCann, which was another advertising company. And we did a lot of good work. And then it was from there that I first became CEO of a production company, which is called Audiovisual First.
Right.
And after 5 years of Audiovisual First, I formed one that I owned wholly. Which was DV Works Studios. And we did a lot of work with DV Works, and over the course of 10 years we've metamorphosed in branding to what is called now Zuri 24 Media.
Okay. And so I think I'd be more interested in like the from the where you said you're part of a team that formed Audiovisual First, and then you moved on to DV Works, and then now that. So what are, in each business, what are the things that you feel changed with each move across?
Well, I think first and foremost, you start out as a creative, thinking that it's really about you. I mean, storytelling and you know, creating products that are inspired tends to make you the center of you know, of your work. And that is very prevalent when you're in spaces like a TV station or spaces like an advertising company. You tend to be really focused on creative production. But as you grow up in that system, you begin to understand that you really lack the understanding of the entrepreneurial part of the business, how the business works. And how the business works, the revelation you find is that creativity is just a product. And that, you know, the inspiration is only the beginning of what becomes money. And so for me, while I was at STB McCann, the agency, I had become an associate creative director, I'd become a senior person, but I really did not have any understanding
of
how the business ran. So when I did become the CEO of Audiovisual First, it was no surprise that my entire focus was on creating things, not on how to run the company. And that's really why I often tell people that my turning point was going to Faith Foundation after 5 years of running Audiovisual First. And the strangest thing was that I did not realize that, you know, I could actually be walked through how to be a businessman. Mm-hmm. So that's really, for me, what I would call the metamorphosis
right.
of me from this single creative focused guy to a creative entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I did go to Faith Foundation while I was at Audiovisual First, and that inspired my change. Mm-hmm. Three things that I think were very important. One, I learned that you needed to understand trends, and at that time, technology was driving trends.
Yeah.
secondly, you needed to understand business plans. And how they work,
right.
Because the consumer and the audience and whoever it is that's buying what you have to sell, you need to understand that. But the thirdly is, how do you become excellent? How do you find that thing that sets you apart? How does your service become something that people want simply because it is superior to whatever else is available?
Right.
And yeah, learning those three things cost me to then decide I was going to form DVWorks when I was going to set off on my own. And yeah, it's interesting because in the first year of DVWorks, we made more money, as in we made a higher billing than I made in 5 years of Audiovisual First.
This is post Faith Foundation.
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting. Wonderful advert right there. So I think for me right now, I would like to know kind of, I mean, you mentioned three things that you found were pertinent to how the business is run after doing Faith Foundation. I'd be interested to know what are the, I suppose, milestones that you set for yourself during the Faith Foundation course, and then how you're able to meet or exceed, or maybe the milestone changed or evolved into something else. What were those?
Well, I mean, the first thing first is that you need to understand how business runs and why business runs. It took me a while to grab the fact that regardless of what it is you do, if it's called a business, the point of it is to make profit for investors.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Mm. And obviously, to make profit for investors, you have to satisfy a need. There has to be something out there that you're delivering that causes consumers to come to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that basic and simple. And my eureka moment at Faith Foundation was we had this gentleman that used to be the DG of the small and medium enterprise unit. His name was Rotimi. I've lost his last name now. He came in to lecture on my very first day, and he asked everyone, what is your annual billing? And when I told him, he looked at me and said, oh, so what you really do is a hobby.
Wow.
Because it was clear to him that, you know, I really did not understand how the value chain worked.
Yeah, yeah.
So if there's any one thing that was important for me,
right.
was to understand, first of all, the consumer, understand the terrain, what's out there, understand the trends,
right.
and then ask yourself, what product can you deliver that is disruptive, that creates value and stands out and causes people to rethink sometimes even what they want.
Right.
And that's really what I immediately did. My first product after was Tinsel.
After Faith Foundation?
After Faith Foundation.
Okay.
And at that time, when people talked about the TV series, they talked about a 13 episode once a week series. And so for the first time, we were trying to do a studio-based daily soap opera that ended up being 260 episodes in 1 year. Now, that was a lot of work. That was destructive.
Yes.
No one had done that.
Yeah.
And we were going to use actors who were not necessarily stars, but we concentrated on learning how this was done in other places. So we took a goalie in South Africa as a model.
Yes.
And I didn't just go to South Africa, I took my entire team to South Africa. So we basically adopted a process. We adopted a process that was tested, but we also adopted a culture. Because at that time, a goalie was already running something like 10 years.
Yes.
And every day.
It was still showing.
He was also relevant. They had in their story for the day, whatever was the front pages of the newspapers the day before. So nothing was stale about it. And that, to us, was extremely challenging. And so we took all our guys there and we learned and we got what you could call their system. We brought it here. And for almost 8 months, we were producing without being out there. And when we did come out, was interesting to me was that everyone thought it was made in South Africa.
Oh, interesting.
And that to me told us how destructive
it was.
Today, Tinsel has shot over 2,500 episodes. Owns his own studios, is a permanent entity. Many stars in the industry have come from it. So it's become a legacy project. I've since moved on to do Battleground. And once again, Battleground has been very disruptive. We've taken a genre that we know that many people are not in. And we did a lot of, we gathered a lot of good people to it. And currently we're working on another show that would launch immediately in October after Big Brother. And we will keep doing that. But that's not the only place we've gone. We've also tried to look at documentary because people were not there. Everybody thought documentary couldn't make money. And we focus our intervention there on a film festival. And IRAP has become something global and interesting. And for me, personally rewarding because, you know, I was invited to the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences simply for founding that festival. So yeah, if there is one thing that's become a recurring, you know, a recurring theme in the story, is that, you know, I Fade Foundation caused me to look at things differently. I don't look at things as an artist. I look at things as an entrepreneur, and if you look at it as an entrepreneur, you create change, you create disruptions, you create new products, you're constantly looking for the gap, not because money is your focus, but because the difference you make will bring you money.
It's quite profound.
that's what I have found, and the business plan and the understanding of the value chain helps you to limit your losses, to limit wastages. And wastages is never just about money. Wastage is not always about, you know, goods or services. Sometimes it's just wastages of time. There are times when, because you don't have a clear view of the value chain, you spend double the time finding your space.
I see.
And I think, you know, the capacity to sit down and plan out on paper the journey, the value chain, saves you a heck of a lot of time. And I've imported that to how I make movies, how I make series. I spend more time in the planning process. I spend more time understanding. I mean, I don't indulge people who want to ideate at the point of execution.
The recipe for disaster.
it happens a lot, especially with young people, because they like the whole bubble of ideation. The fact that, you know, I get this inspiration and I'm flying with it is great, but you don't get a chance to test it. You don't get a chance to question it. You don't get a chance to see if it's got longevity. Will it replicate itself over time? And of course, who wants it? Who wants to buy it?
Is there a market for it?
Is there a market? As a younger creative, I mean, when I talk to my younger self now, it's usually a whole bunch of laughter at how foolish I truly was. I absolutely used to totally enjoy, you know, my own stories, and I would totally just binge on one simple plot that I was thinking about. But these plots don't last more than a short film. Mm-hmm. And so it was never likely to be profitable.
I see.
But, you know, that's really what I think has really made a difference for me.
That's great. So we heard a bit about your successes in the many, many areas that you've gone through. Can you talk a bit about the challenges that you faced and across your career?
I think that, you know, now as I grow old, I realize that, you know, failure is actually an important part of your process.
Yes.
If you don't fail, you really don't have the capacity to succeed in a profound way. Mm-hmm. The moment I described to you at Faith Foundation, where, you know, the lecturer said to me what I had was a hobby. not a
career,
business.
Yeah.
I always repeat it because it's a seminal moment where you realize, where I realized that, quite honestly, the last 5 years before then, I'd been a total, you know, walking around blind. I never forget the moment, because the same gentleman eventually, at a small and medium enterprise that he ran, gave a colleague and me, Dr. Bayo Adipeto, opportunity to access 100 million naira in loans to build what became Medivision and Mediterm.
So to move your hobby to a real business.
Exactly.
Basically.
But he had to see me. I mean, we became good friends and he was wonderfully helpful to me. Mm. But he had to see me actually admit my
shortcomings,
the gap. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was one moment. When I came out of NTA to come to Lagos, I failed serially, missing opportunities that I could have. If I knew what I know now, I would possibly have transited into content earlier than I did. And that's not it's not a failure as much as a missed opportunity. And I think that's very critical, because I did not have the capacity to have a bird's eye view of the industry and see where the gaps were. And so I simply went with whatever someone else was doing or whatever everybody said was the thing to do.
Yeah.
But then I can almost excuse that, because when you're young, you're just kind of blind and finding your way. Mm-hmm. But the margin of difference has been, and I say to young people who I mentor here, the difference between the richest man in the world and me is how much information
you both have.
He has. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that information is only about himself. And I think if you ask me, the foundations of my early failures was that I didn't know myself. I valued myself only as a story creator.
Right.
And my only moments of affirmation was when I had a story. But the world is full of stories. The world is full of storytellers. Mm-hmm. It took a while to understand that I could hire one.
You don't have to create one.
You don't have to. Mm-hmm. And the validity, I did not need all of that to be valid as a professional.
Right.
And that's maybe where it's at. What are the lessons I've learned failing? Well, one, it's important to understand that you're not alone. You're not the greatest failure. You're not the one that has failed first. Mm-hmm. There are people who are failing all the time. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is, do you see why?
You failed.
Mm-hmm. And then obviously, be uncomfortable in failure. Because I do think there are times when people fail and they call it depression, but sometimes I think it's a comfort with where they are. They create levels of reasons and excuses why they are giving it a try. And then you can blame the country, you can blame the economy, and you can blame everything. And then find a place of comfort there. Mm-hmm. Be uncomfortable with failure. But find out why you failed. Mm-hmm. There's always information out there. Mm-hmm. And that information sometimes is secondly with the mentor. I find that the margin of difference between failure and success, especially in our environment, is who is your mentor. And for me, the mentor is not someone that you have to know. Mentoring for me is about reviewing and researching someone's process. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people with outcomes that you would love, mm-hmm. but processes that you may not. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes the process is so personal to them that you can't really replicate. Mm-hmm. But if the process seems to have interesting steps that, you know, kind of move things forward, mm-hmm. you want to review and adopt.
I see.
And that to me is the second lesson, to find something that represents what you want to be. For me, thirdly, people talk about hard work. Mm. I'm not sure hard work is really the point. Mm. Smart work is. Mm-hmm. And in the age of technology, smart work is easier than ever. you take a model and remodel, and you can do this on paper. Mm-hmm. And that's really, for me, the third key. Everything I have done, I model out, mm-hmm. I interrogate on paper. I look for what the financial institutions say about it.
I see.
There are times when I offer something, I want a loan on something. I really don't want the loan. I just want the interrogation process.
From the financial institutions?
From the financial institutions. Mm. Because I find that the financial institutions are keener than you not to lose money. And they tend to ask questions mm-hmm. that you might not have considered.
Right.
But beyond that, they have contacts and people mm-hmm. who may have a synergic connection to what you're trying to do. They're also in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. So when you set what your pricing is, when you sometimes become overly optimistic and you set mm-hmm. They know what real values are.
Right.
They know who's paying what for what.
Yes.
And when they give you that feedback in the process of asking them, mm-hmm. it's more valuable, and sometimes you don't have to pay for that because they're still trying to defend
free
themselves. Exactly. And you can get to the end and say, you know what, I don't think I want the loan.
I've gotten what I needed for.
Well, you don't say that part. you simply... But information is a critical difference between success and failure mm-hmm. all the time. So I study rapidly, I read a lot, I listen to people mm-hmm. Who are in the business I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's very important to also understand environmental factors, of course, which mm-hmm. is you can take something that works in the US or works in Britain mm-hmm. and bring it here mm-hmm. and nobody understands why.
It's not working.
There are those factors that I think are also critical
okay.
to what you're doing.
I'm also interested because predominantly you are a content creator, even as a business person, you're in the business of content creation. So how would you say across the three companies, well, two and a half, two companies, your content creation process itself, because you mentioned process and being able to replicate or study someone else's. So how would you say your process has changed between these two and a half?
It's evolved. I think the bigger, the higher the stakes, mm-hmm. the more your system has to become more efficient. Mm-hmm. So on the TV front, there is a content creation system now that has a large writing team that focuses on doing that. There is, on the film side, there are producers now that, you know, are doing that. And there is a process with which they work. I'm able to supervise things. And also I'm able to bring to the table the little bit that I know. But I think at the end of the day, you cannot personalize a business. You must figure out how you find champions and people of excellence in different areas of it, but you must identify those. And I think that's really maybe my biggest task today, is to constantly look in the industry and look at those who have excellence and who have creativity and who are looking to create big things, and you know, work with them. Hire them if they're available, or just simply partner with them. And of course, that's led me to this project of mentoring at the Talent Factory, because I do feel that, you know, the creative industries has too few people who have the benefit of a combination of creativity and entrepreneurship. And that's what we try to do here, is to create storytellers who are sensitive to the demands of the economy of creative industries.
Okay. So just because you mentioned a lot of reflection in the past, if you had like one lesson that you would tell your just starting the company self, what would that one lesson be?
Know your consumer.
Know your consumer.
Know your consumer. I think often people create systems and companies and they are all about self-validation. Sometimes it's about making money. Unless the goal of it is clearly delivering value, you will have problems. There are people who are incredibly great as employees, and they will stay great as long as there is a vision leader, as long as there is a system that is cozy and protects them. But in the wilderness of entrepreneurship, the only value that gives you comfort is when that consumer, that service, the person needing your service, you know, is able to come back again and again. And the only way to get them to come back again and again is to know what they want, not what you want. And for me, that is all. That translates whether you're writing columns for newspapers, or you are making TV shows, or you are selling, you know, agege bread. Whatever it is, the consumer is key, and that's maybe what I have brought to what I do. And I find that it's worked very well. We tell stories from the eye of the consumer. Now we do this on and off offline loop. Where we take the comments and feedbacks and of the audience and who they like and what storylines they like, and we incorporate it back into the story. And you find that they come back on Monday and they see something they said online and they think to themselves, man, I'm brilliant. and it just keeps them with the show. There is a loyalty thing that comes with co-creation.
They kind of buy into it.
And I find that to be a good lesson. Regardless of what it is you do, the consumer is king.
That's great. Could you tell me a bit about how your leadership style has changed, has evolved across? Because you did mention having a visionary leader, how that helps navigate the...
Well, I think it's important to give people... Well, first thing first is to find people of talent. Real talent, not talkers, not... You know, there are people who have great CVs, but they really never accomplished anything. I'm not interested in where you went to school, what your CV is. I will research and talk to people and find out what your skill set is. I hope it's focused on one thing. I don't like people who do seven things, because, you know. So find that talent. Then I like the emotional intelligence. Part. I'm also very keen that the person is stable, ambitious, humble enough to understand that none of us knows everything and would be coming in to work in a team. I think that's the first breakthrough. The second breakthrough when you hire a talented, ingenious person is to let them be talented and ingenious. You cannot hire them, pay them well, and then do their job. So I find that ultimately what I've learned is that what really creates magic is to find the talent, set a high bar, and allow them to work. And it's amazing because all you got to do after that is protect and give them a safe zone to work. Tend to their own personal issues to the extent that it can distract. But essentially, you know, inspire them by setting goals that are always high. And I think that creates for you something everybody looks forward to. And if you get it right on many levels, you create a team that's always ambitious, always trying to do things. Yeah. But why are you in this business? Why? What fascinates you about leading in a creative environment?
To be honest, I didn't say that I didn't want to be a leader. I didn't sign up for this, I really didn't. I didn't want to be a leader. Like you, I'm also very interested in storytelling in whatever form. And I actually started in a very different form of storytelling. So my background is in animation and game development. So I was working as a game developer, so telling stories in an interactive, so it's using technology, as you mentioned, to kind of disrupt the storytelling scene there. So coming back to Nigeria and trying to plug into a non-existent space, because that was a very different and very infantile industry. It still is, but it's gradually growing. So my hobby in university was editing. Okay. I had a professor who was a producer on a show, and if they needed extra hands, she would call me in. So I kind of had some sort of experience in that. So it was kind of like the same things where I had friends in the industry, and they're like, oh, you can edit, please come and help me. Right. And then before you know it, I plugged into the film and entertainment industry. But at the core of it, I mean, I'd worked there for a while, but at the core of it, I knew that I didn't want to stay here. Like, I still wanted to go back to what it is that I was interested in. And I wasn't seeing any platform. Because for me, the storytelling, I didn't have a particular format that I wanted to do. Like, it wasn't film that I wanted to do. It wasn't animation that I wanted to do. For me, it was more about, okay, there is this great story. What is the best way to tell it? Which medium or which format would be the best way to get the story to relate with people? So I didn't find that there was a platform that did that. People were either doing films or documentary or a mixture of both or TV. There wasn't room for experimenting and challenging whether this platform is the best thing for the story. So that is where I'm like, oh, okay, so I guess I have to form, to create the platform. And that's where Girl Studios was found. And Girl Studios literally is the West African word for a storyteller, a historian and an oral historian. So that's kind of how I found myself in the forefront.
I find it fascinating because you're in a space that's got a lot of opportunity. I mean, the children's market. So it's good we're talking about consumers and we're talking about customers. And the game market, the animation market, I think is so huge and it's ready. But have you thought about, you know, partnering to commission with a broadcaster something or actually creating the games that have localized storytelling?
Well, we have. So the thing is, I get this a lot. When I say animation and games, people assume that my target audience is children.
Yes.
But the target audience is, it depends on what the narrative of the, because you do have adult targeted, you do have elderly targeted content as well. So in terms of collaboration, the very first thing that I knew that I had to do was get a team. Because as you've mentioned, you can't do it by yourself, and especially given how complex these even with film, even something as simple as a short film, simple I feel is an understatement, is not, there's already a system where you need to work with so many different people. So it's more of, for me, we are collaborating with people on a very small scale, but it's more of capacity building. Because if, as you said, we with a business, if you want to take a risk with that business, you need to have the resources, the human resources, to be able to handle whatever it is that you plan on creating. So we do have like very small collaborations that we're using to build capacity, as well as to get more people interested, because there is a misconception about when you say games, where people are thinking console games, or people are thinking, oh, for children, all these gun and violence and whatever. And when you say animation, oh, cartoons for children. So trying to kind of get people and to see how, because one of the key things I noticed is that a lot of very talented Nigerians aren't aware how transferable their skills are. So you find people that have developed apps and software, but they say, well, I can't do game development. It's literally the same skill sets. It's just in a different way. And having to get people, because once you start saying, oh, you can't like micromanage people to get them. Like you said, if you get a talented person, let them be talented. So if you're not getting, if I start explaining it to you and you're not getting it that, okay, this is exactly what I do, then I feel like we can't, you're not ready. Maybe we cannot, right? Maybe at this point you're not ready for us to get on board, because that would mean at every point we would have to come back to this.
Of course.
You know, so.
Of course. Well, that's exciting. I mean, I say the landscape of Nigeria is such that opportunity is always right there.
Right.
And it's a delight to meet you. I was part of the Lagos Animation Festival at Freedom Park.
Right.
I was one of the keynote speakers. I did enjoy seeing an industry that was basically not there, beginning to have
to flourish,
lights. So that's pretty cool.
So that was great.
I thought so too.
So one of the things that I really liked you mentioned is about like studying processes that exist. So because of the unique nature of our country and how it works, not on paper, but in reality, how would you, I think maybe the word would be advice, an entrepreneur whose process, either the ones that exist will not work here, and because there is, there's not that much information, like you rightfully mentioned, about processes that current entrepreneurs or existing players in the field have gone through. Either it's because it's more personal, or either it's just not documented. It's not something that is available. Even if it is documented, there's no access to it. So how would you advise such an entrepreneur to proceed, in that they do want to study this and see how viable it is, but there is no existing model, or they don't have access to an existing model that would work here?
Well, I suppose for every new thing, there are two levels of the models that I think you need to research. The first model is how business transactions operate, but the other is efficiency driven. How efficient can this thing we want to do fit into the transaction model that is here? The transaction model works for every product, because that's the culture of business in the country or in the environment. And often the one that cannot be easily, you know, changed, because there are things in there that are fundamental. But the efficiency needs is your issue. And the strategies for efficiency need not be mirrored to exactly the same business. There will be businesses, I mean, obviously the creative industries or the intellectual property industry is at a particular risk in our environment anyway. But the question is, are there industries that can mirror that? I think there are. And you can actually research widely, and you'll see even Coca-Cola have a system in place that, you know, is both protective and adaptive enough to function in this economic space. But I think globally, first thing you have to mirror is the end quality of your delivery. That end quality, because it's a global world, cannot be compromised. That cannot be tailored to the environment. Every consumer, whether it be in Nigeria or Venezuela, want the same high quality, superior, excellent end product. Why? Because the walls are down and they're able to consume that same product from everywhere else. So for me, it's then three things. One is to find the global quality. Secondly, to create a process to deliver that quality at the same quality at the same pace, at the same time, every time. That's the efficiency part. And then thirdly, to model, how do companies survive in this space? That third one has a lot of people that can talk to you. There are issues to do with, you know, how taxes impact you and impact your pricing.
Yes.
There are issues to do with regulatory authorities and how in Nigeria or in African countries generally, they can be almost the terrorists you're trying to avoid. There can be pockets of, you know, people who also try to corner that business and resist a younger, newer, different voice coming in. But there is always a solution for all of that. And the solution for all of that is to find the right mentor. He would give advice. Sometimes he will give the network you need to break those things. And more than anything else, information. There's nothing that makes a policeman stop talking than if he finds out you know the code. You actually know the traffic code, or you can actually quote it. Of course, they'll tell you to carry your wahala and go. So it's important that you're not ignorant of rules and regulations in the industry in which you operate. But you must work in a global way and be connected to every part of it while protecting this part, which is your efficiency and your product. You have responsibility for this, but this, it shifts and changes. And you may actually have people who take care of it for you, but a mentor is critical here, especially one who has maybe not conquered the system, but has survived in it.
He's doing well in it.
I think that to me is really the key. Lastly, I always, you know, I was going to say this before, enthusiasm is really key for an entrepreneur. And I find that the people that have the reservoir of enthusiasm are usually the young. So when I'm looking for what I call combustions of ideas and new thinking, I tend to just situate them. If you're an entrepreneur, there's a lot of disappointments to come. Sometimes not because things have gone bad, but things have not gone as good as you hoped. And you're human, you do get that downer. But at the end of the day, you know, if you've got that energetic group, they feed you, you know, they help you go on. And I know everything I've said sometimes sound like money is the goal. Money is not the goal for me. The goal for me is really fulfillment.
But it's a good incentive.
There's not a lot you can do without it. And then, you know, but I almost can guarantee you will do very well. So the trick is to keep that vision and keep on keeping on, as they say.
Well, thank you for your time and for the wealth of knowledge and your experience that you've shared.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Journeys in Entrepreneurship. This interview was recorded on the 30th of August, 2019. At the Multi-Choice Talent Factory, Victoria Island, Lagos. Journeys in Entrepreneurship's executive producer is Adenike Adeyemi. Our technical producer and director is Elo Iyamu. This series was reviewed by Miriam Adeoti, Feisha Yoshogeson, and Loretta Ihel-Mere. The artwork and design was done by Kingsley Effion, while the video production and editing was by U-Visuals. The theme song for this series, which you're also listening to now, was put together by Tani and Shemilore Olujipe. To watch videos of this recording, please visit faithfoundation.org/podcast and also the Faith Foundation YouTube channel. Remember to join us next week Friday for an all-new episode. Thank you.